This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet a pair of award-winning Wisconsin farmers who overhauled their operation with sustainability and conservation in mind. Now, cases of the new Omicron variant are spreading quickly around the country. That's having a big impact, among others, on small businesses. In the last 2 years, they've weathered shutdowns, capacity restrictions, and the financial toll of the pandemic. Now, workers are calling in sick in the middle of a nationwide labor shortage, leading some workplaces to be so short-staffed they have to temporarily shut their doors. We're talking now about how small businesses are doing at this point in the pandemic, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been going out to bars and restaurants, or have you started to scale back with COVID-19 cases rising? Are you a small business owner yourself? Are customers showing up? Are you having trouble with staffing? Are you having a lot of staff out because of positive COVID tests? Are you able to keep your doors open? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth Simon covers small business and entrepreneurship for the Wall Street Journal. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You've been following the staffing challenges Omicron is creating for businesses. How common is it for workplaces to have multiple staff members out at the same time with a positive COVID test?
It's incredibly common. Lots and lots of small businesses are struggling with this. Either workers are positive, or they have family members who are positive, or they've been exposed to someone who tested positive. And for a lot of small business owners, every day is juggling. They wake up and they don't know who's going to be in and who's not going to be able to make it.
You and your colleagues have talked to business owners really around the country dealing with this. Are there particular sectors, particular kinds of workplaces that you found are being hit particularly hard?
I think it's particularly hard for businesses that do face-to-face contact. So we talked to restaurants, salons, spas. They were all having a hard time. My colleagues today were reporting about how manufacturers are also having trouble as well, and some of them are having to slow down production.
Are we seeing places have to shut their doors, not because of, you know, a public shutdown order or anything like that, but just because they simply don't have the human power?
Yes, I did talk to some businesses that had to temporarily shut down because they did not have enough workers. I talked to a salon owner who had to shut down for 2 weeks in the middle of December because 15 of his 18-person staff had tested positive for the virus. I talked to a restaurant owner in Boston that had to close down for a couple days last week because he just did not have enough staff.
Now, we've seen small businesses, especially the restaurants and other, as you said, you know, face-to-face businesses, they took hits from shutdown orders when they could be open. Maybe customers were reluctant to go in. Now, this, can you talk about the financial toll this series of events is taking on some of these outfits?
I think it's both a financial toll and also a mental toll. So they're not pulling in the revenue that they would if they could be fully up and running. Some of them have had to reduce hours. And I think also the business owners are just exhausted. It's been a very tough couple of years. And I think one of the very hard things is a lot of people thought that the worst of it was over in October. Many of the businesses that I talked to have staffs that were vaccinated and boosted. And for the most part, people aren't going into the hospital among the employees of the businesses I talk to, but they're not coming into work either.
Talking to Ruth Simon with the Wall Street Journal, looking at the impact of the latest COVID-19 surge on businesses, especially small businesses. You can join in with your firsthand report at your workplace at 800-642-1234. Is it tough getting enough staff to keep the doors open between a labor shortage and a lot of positive test cases? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Ruth, this is all happening amidst a wider labor shortage, even when we don't have a COVID surge, right? Is that affecting some of these businesses you talk to?
That's absolutely true. In the past months, even before this hit, just about every business I spoke with was having trouble finding the workers they needed. So many of them were short-staffed to begin with, and this just adds to that pain and that anxiety. And I think one of the other things that's really hard is sometimes they don't know. Someone may have the sniffles or a sore throat, and they don't know. Is that just a cold, or is that COVID?
Right. Our business is working to try to make sure they can get tests for people to answer that question.
Some businesses are. I think it's harder for small businesses. It can be costly to get the tests. The tests have been hard in some locations to get.
There have been a series of relief efforts going back to 2020, many of them helping some of the specific businesses we've been talked about, the hardest hit businesses. Is that money still out there, still flowing, or is there talk of maybe a new round in Congress?
The money from the Paycheck Protection Program, which was the big aid program for small businesses, that's all gone and done. I focus more on talking to the businesses than to members of Congress. I think there's been some talk about that. I know restaurants have been pushing for more relief. I can't give you odds on it, though.
Sure. Now, school openings and closures, another factor here. Are you hearing from businesses, not just, hey, my employee's relative is sick, but my employee's kid can't go into school because they were shut down because of staffing shortages, and that has that domino effect?
And that's another issue. If your kid can't get to school, I mean, last year that was a big challenge and kept a lot of people home. So there are these tremendous ripple effects. Someone was raising with me the point, if the bus drivers can't pick up the kids for school, or, you know, there are just all these effects through the economy.
When you talk to business owners, are they feeling like if they just get through this one more surge, they can get back to normal? Or are they kind of in a, oh, no, not again phase still?
One of the business owners I talked to, he said about 30% of his staff had had the virus, and he was really hoping that he was near the end of it. If you look at the experience in South Africa, there's been some talk that this surge will die down. I think the hard thing is we don't know what will come next, but there is a hope that they can, many people are hoping they'll get through this surge and things will get back to at least some semblance of normal.
I heard from a caller who can't come on the air, who works for the post office, said they're short staffed there. It's restricting their ability to take vacations. Even when they can show up, the short staffing affects the workers there. And we'd already heard, Ruth, about a burnout facing a lot of employees in workplaces during COVID. Is this, you know, I'm the one cook who can show up at the restaurant today? Is that increasing that feeling of burnout?
I think it is. And you find that business owners are asking employees who are healthy, can they put in extra hours? One salon owner that I talked to said several of his employees volunteered to work an extra 10 hours each so they could keep that particular salon open because so many people were out sick. But it is exhausting. It does take a toll on both workers and employers.
We're talking to Ruth Simon. She covers small business and entrepreneurship for the Wall Street Journal. She's with us today to talk about how small businesses are doing at this point in the pandemic. A big story here, trouble keeping staff at the workplace in part because of very common positive COVID tests. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen these changes? You've seen short staffing in the small businesses where you live, maybe the workplace where you work. If you're a customer regularly of bars and restaurants, are you slowing things down? Maybe ordering from home instead? If you're a small business owner yourself, how is this latest surge in cases affecting your workplace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll check out what's going on at some Wisconsin businesses. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at the rise in COVID-19 cases around the country and specifically what it means for workplaces, restaurants, shops, other small businesses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this hit your business yet? Whether you're a business owner or you work at one, if you're a restaurant worker, Love to hear what you're seeing. Are people coming in to dine in? Are you short-staffed, overworked? Are you a former restaurant worker by choice? Have you left that field in the last couple of years? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us how the latest COVID surge is affecting your workplace. Ruth Simon stays with us from the Wall Street Journal. Now Christine Hadfield joins us with a closer look at Wisconsin businesses. She's WPR's Second Century News Fellow. Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
You talked to some small business owners in Wisconsin. What kind of things did they tell you about how Omicron is impacting them?
I mean, Rich Kramer and I, he was the other reporter on this story. We talked to a few business owners. I will preface, this was mainly Milwaukee, Madison. Odds are the situation will be a little bit different in the other parts of the state. I mean, we're just seeing a wide range of effects, even besides people actually getting COVID. Some businesses are mandating vaccines, which of course is following the lead of some cities nationally that have put blanket rules in place like that. Still kind of uncommon here, though. Others are requiring masks beyond Dane County, of course, which is still requiring mask wearing. And then we're also seeing some other areas getting impacted too. I mean, last week's U.S. Olympic speed skating trials, those were in Milwaukee. Last second decision, they ended up doing them without a live audience of spectators. And the effects of this, I would say, are just wide reaching. I mean, it may not be March 2020 levels, but we are still seeing this very clearly.
And you and Rich reported on Milwaukee restaurants. It sounds like exactly what we're hearing from Ruth. Nationwide, they're in some cases having trouble keeping enough, you know, cooks and wait staff on hand.
Right. I mean, for these business owners, I would echo what Ruth said. The pandemic fatigue is very real. And it's the sort of thing where they're not even bracing for the surge. It's already hit the surge. One of the business owners I talked to was Dan Jacobs. He runs three restaurants in the Milwaukee area. What he told me, one thing he said that stuck with me was it's been difficult to build up momentum because every time his restaurants are starting to get to that point, something terrible happens that sends them careening right back down again. One of his restaurants is Fool's Errand. They closed on the 26th last month after a few employees tested positive for COVID. They only just reopened late last week. And then another Milwaukee restaurant, Odd Duck, they told Rich almost a third of their staff had COVID in the course of 2 weeks. There's just this feeling of we've done everything right and still it's come to this. These places haven't given up, of course. They're persevering, but the morale is just so low right now.
And Christine, before I let you go, you also talked to somebody with a business group in the Milwaukee area, basically begging people to listen to hospitals and other healthcare providers when it comes to vaccines and masking.
Yeah, I talked to, I'm the name escapes me, but I talked to this one gentleman who basically, he had to put out a message to the Chamber of Commerce that said, yeah, we're struggling here. Please take this seriously. We're barely hanging on. And it's a fine line you have to walk because, I mean, of course you want these businesses to succeed, but also you have to know when to take that step back. And by and large, at least in this neck of the woods, people are trying their best to take that step back while also keeping their businesses afloat.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you once again.
That was WPR's Christine Hadfield with us today to talk about how small businesses in Wisconsin are being affected by the Omicron surge. Ruth Simon from the Wall Street Journal is still with us. Ruth, Christine said, yeah, these businesses, their goal, of course, is to stay open in the long run. Have you seen, though, businesses have to shut down, that don't weather the storm here?
I've seen businesses temporarily shut down because of this rise in virus cases. We have seen businesses permanently shut down over the course of the pandemic, not as many as was initially expected, in part because there was a fair amount of government aid. And I think the full impact of this will depend on how long it lasts. Everyone's hoping it will be short, painful, but short.
Now, we've been focusing on small businesses, restaurants, and others. Earlier, you mentioned manufacturers, which people don't necessarily think of feeling the impact of this. Can you talk a little more about how Omicron surges are affecting the manufacturing sector?
like the restaurants or the salons or the spas, the manufacturers need workers on their premises. And so even if you're feeling kind of okay, but you're testing positive, you can't come in. And so I know, based on the reporting of some of my colleagues, some manufacturers who were already, like a lot of other businesses, didn't have enough workers, they're short on employees, so they've had to reduce production, or like these other businesses, have people put in more overtime. And it's very difficult because, again, these businesses have been strained already by the tight labor market and the other challenges related to supply chains and the virus and the like.
Right. And then does that in turn affect the supply chain more? If manufacturers can't go at full capacity, that, I don't know, small business owner who's counting on their products might be hit too.
And that's something we've heard throughout the pandemic about people having different shortages. At the end of last year, I did some reporting on the company that produces Fiestaware, and they had trouble getting the boxes, the cardboard boxes, to ship some of their China. So there is this ripple effect.
Ruth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us today.
It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
That's Ruth Simon. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers small business and entrepreneurship. She was with us today to talk about the latest rise in COVID-19 cases and specifically how that's affecting small businesses around the country. And earlier, we got a report from Wisconsin with WPR's Second Century News fellow Christine Hatfield. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about encountering a stranger on a snowy road.
Driving home on a snowy Wisconsin night, author Crystal Chan and her mother encountered a hitchhiker in the blowing snow. The question of whether to pick him up or not led her to explore the meaning and limits of compassion. She brings us the story.
It was a bad snowstorm, the kind that wipes out your vision, erases the world, and makes you brake for a red light a full city block before you come to the intersection. It was nighttime, and my mom and I were in the car heading home over the viaduct on 20th Avenue in Oshkosh. The radio was off as my mom handled the vehicle on the heavy, slippery roads. That was when we saw him, a figure, hunched over, walking on the sidewalk on that viaduct in full blast of the winter storm. In fact, because of the storm, we almost didn't see him. What could he possibly be doing in a storm like this? I asked my mom. I don't know, she said. He trudged along. We inched along. Mom paused. Should we pick him up? I was surprised at her question. There are dangers out there, murderers and rapists and thieves. There we were, two women in a car in a snowstorm, the heater blazing. There he was, a young man, hunched over into the blinding winds, almost disappeared from view. You couldn't help but feel for him. I'd never picked up anyone before. I had a good hunch that my mom hadn't either. Yeah, I said. Let's pick him up. I rolled down my window. Hey, where are you going? I asked. He told us. The location was halfway across town. In the darkness, I looked at Mom and she looked at me. I looked back at him. Come on in if you want, I said. We'll take you there. We rolled to a slow stop, and he opened the door to the back seat. A blast of cold air followed him in. We asked him some general questions, but he didn't say much, so we crawled through town in silence. I was sweating under my winter coat. He is in our car, I thought. I cannot believe we actually picked up a stranger. Mom gripped the steering wheel with both hands. The man spoke only to give us directions to the house, and when we pulled alongside it, he thanked us twice, then got out. As soon as he left, it was as if a sudden storm had lifted, even though it was still snowing. We turned around and crawled our slow way home, both deeply shaken, both deeply pleased. It's easy to say that compassion is a good thing. It's much harder to live it out, especially when you need to weigh things like risk and danger and fear. Mom and I both agreed that had we been the only one in the car, we would have kept driving. If there had been two men walking, we would have kept driving, and so forth. There are no easy answers, and I've messed up this equation more times than I'd like, preferring the route of safety to the route of lived-out compassion. But in extending that gesture of decency, somehow I felt more human in the process, more connected, less alone. It can be mysterious how compassion works, and how the strangest gifts can come in the strangest packaging in a snowstorm on a cold winter night.
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and author based in Chicago. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor, and this time around, it's going back to basics with an introduction to home repair, advice on manageable products that you could do yourself. Don't be shy. If you need some help or advice, you can get started right now. Email your questions to ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. Also tomorrow, it was a big moment in Wisconsin sports history as the UW-Madison women's volleyball team took the national championship. The team's coach joins the show for a look back at the winning season and what's to come. And you can join in with your questions and your favorite moments along the way if you were watching. And it's the latest installment in a series of interviews with mayors from around Wisconsin. This week, we'll take a visit to Sheboygan. That's all coming up tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a national Smithsonian touring exhibit about bias is making a couple stops here in Wisconsin. We'll talk with the tour's project manager and a UW Green Bay partner about what people can expect and learn. Now we'll meet two Wisconsin farmers who have made conservation a key part of their work. The Wisconsin Leopold Conservation Award recognizes farmers and landowners for their work conserving and improving the land. That award's given out each year by the Sand County Foundation, American Farmland Trust, Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, and Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin. The 2021 winners of the Leopold Conservation Award are Dorothy and John Prisky, who own Fountain Prairie Farm in Fall River. Dorothy and John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Hello, Rob. Thank you very much.
Well, Dorothy, can you start off by telling us a little bit about your farm, the history, and what you produce?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We bought our farm in 1986. It's 280 acres. When we bought the farm, it was one cornfield. The entire farm was one large field. And we raised corn and soybeans on that land until about 1998, when we switched to an all-grass system. And then we decided, well, we have to have an animal to eat that grass, and we chose a Scottish Highland cattle, and that's what we did until we retired last year.
And John, you two got this award and other awards over the years for conservation. What made you come into farming with this particular focus on conservation and sustainability?
Well, I'm not sure that you actually come into it with anything in mind. It's something that develops when you're on the job. And naturally, when we got to this farm, like Dorothy said, it was one big cornfield. And so there were a lot of things that we needed to fix. Our organic matter was low. We had washouts. And, you know, there's many, many ways to farm and many ideas on how to farm that land. But each piece of land is unique and each farmer is unique. And So we always practiced good conservation as best we could, but we had this epiphany in the late 90s. And I think that's probably what got us this recognition. And when we switched to a grass-based farming system, we also went to direct marketing our beef to restaurants in Madison and at the Dane County Farmers Market. And some of the things that brought us to these, the question is always, why did you do what you did? And it's very difficult, but you might say that we kind of educated ourselves. We had this epiphany, and we're kind of disciples of all the Leopold, John Muir, Wisconsin's big on all of our conservationists, and reading books by Wendell Berry and Michael Pollan and Alan Savory on holistic management. And, you know, we came to the conclusion that the best way for Dorothy and I to farm and put meaning and purpose back into our work was to kind of express ourselves. And we did that by realizing that, you know, we collected the energy from the sun, solar energy, and that was the driving force of how we wanted to farm. And that, we put a complete cover over the land with grass, and with the cattle, we could see the expression in things that you can't see, the life underneath that grass in the soil that gives birth to everything. And the cattle, they did the harvesting and the fertilizing, and we managed them through rotational grazing, similar to how bison would have been moved on the prairie by predators. And the idea of the whole rotational grazing method is rest, let the land rest, come in and eat and work up the soil, till the soil, and then move on. And because of that, we ended up with a lot of biodiversity, songbirds that we have, bobolinks and meadowlarks, and we have a ton of sandhill cranes, and it just put happiness back into our life.
Dorothy, can you talk go ahead, Dorothy.
Well, I was going to say, one of Leopold's quotes that really resonates with us is, the landscape of any farm is the owner's portrait of himself. And I guess you could sum that up and say that, as John said, in the late 90s, that the farm was no longer a reflection of who we were. And we knew we needed to make a change.
We're talking to Dorothy and John Priske, who own Fountain Prairie Farm in Fall River. They're the winners of the Wisconsin Leopold Conservation Award this year. Dorothy, the kind of things you're talking about, they're not things where you could just flip a switch and everything's different now. Can you talk about the long-term planning and work that went into some of the changes you made?
Well, you're right. It took us about 3 years to totally transition our farm from corn and soybeans to grass. And we decided that cattle were going to be the animals to harvest that grass. And well, I don't know if you know, but, you know, the gestation period of a cow is 9 months, and then the calf has to grow for, in our case, 2.5 years before it's marketable as beef. So there was a long period there where we didn't have any income coming in. And that was stressful, to say the least.
John, if a farmer's listening and saying, hey, I want to make this kind of switch, and like you said, what works on your specific piece of land might not work on theirs, what would you suggest to them to kind of adopt your mindset, though?
Well, Dorothy and I have always felt that, you know, we don't try to educate. We do educate a lot of people, but we don't preach about it. What we do is we just try to be a good example. And whether you're driving by our farm or you're overhead looking at our farm as a wild goose would fly over, it looks inviting. There's something about our farm that people have liked. And that has been very rewarding. And so I would say to farmers that, and I think that a lot of, almost all farmers that I know are really into conservation. They're utilizing techniques like cover crops and some rotational plantings of row crops and mixing in some alfalfa and wheat to change up the monoculture. So I think there's a lot of, awful lot of work being done in that area.
And Dorothy, John mentioned education, and that reminds me, you've donated, I understand, 165 acres of your land to Madison College to use for agriculture students, potentially the farmers of the future. Why did you want to make that move?
Well, I just want to make one thing clear first, Rob. We didn't donate it. They rented it from
us.
I see.
Okay.
For 2 years. We thought the premise was really worthwhile. It's hard for young people to get into farming these days. First of all, it's terribly expensive. And we thought the Madison College program helped educate them. And John and I have always been interested in education. One of our other little mottos is educate, share, and learn. So we were thrilled to have Madison College here, and the chef put in a large garden. They brought students out to harvest and cook on the farm, and they also mentored beginning farmer on the farm. So it was a really rewarding experience for us.
And John, as we wrap up, you mentioned retiring. What are you hoping for, though, for the future of your land?
Well, Rob, I think that's the challenge of a lot of older farmers, how to transition out of farming. And we're still working on that. That's probably the biggest challenge that we have had and will have here in the near future. I don't have the answers for that. We do have a young renter on the land that we're hoping... you know, something will come of that. But like Dorothy said, it takes a lot of money to come in and work a farm. And one of the things that Dorothy and I did, we put a conservation easement on the farm, so it will always remain a farm. And we encourage people to do that. And we work with an organization called Groundswell. They hold the easement. And so that just means that nothing will be developed. Because we do see a lot of farmland that's being taken out of production. And one of our goals was to protect the farmland. Yeah. As far as transitioning, if you have any of the answers, you let me know.
I don't. Congratulations on the award. And thank you so much for joining us today, both of you.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Rob.
That's John and Dorothy Prisky, owners of Found Prairie Farm in Fall River, winners of the 2021 Wisconsin Leopold Conservation Award. Coming up, we'll learn about a national project coming to Wisconsin that's teaching communities about different forms of bias and how they can work to counter it. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A national educational tour and exhibit from the Smithsonian has been working its way around the Midwest. This weekend, it opens at UW Green Bay, and at the end of February, it will be in Eau Claire. The project is working with local communities around the country to encourage learning and dialogue about bias, what it is, how to recognize it in ourselves, and how to address some of the problems it can create in society. Laura Zell is project manager for the Bias Inside Us Tour from the Smithsonian Institution Traveling Exhibition Service. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
And Mai J. Lowley is director of the Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs Office at UW Green Bay. Mai, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having us today.
Well, Laura, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little more about what inspired this project from the Smithsonian?
Absolutely. So the idea, it was actually started by a group, a Minneapolis-St. Paul group called Tolerance in Motion. And in about 2015, joined forces with the Smithsonian Institution Traveling Exhibition Service, began collaborating, building out exactly what this education should look like, engaged with several advisory groups around the country, and voila, the traveling exhibition was born.
And the key here is traveling, Laura. I know I can go to Washington and see a lot of great stuff at the various Smithsonian museums and institutions. Why was this important to take this on the road?
Well, it's what CITES does. You know, for more than 70 years, they, you know, not everyone can go to Washington, D.C., and their mission is really to bring the Smithsonian out to people across the country, especially in topics of science and history and art and culture. And this was a perfect way to have a really important conversation across the country and engage with partners such as MI and Green Bay, because that partnership is actually key to going deeper under this subject.
And Mai, can you talk about that, the significance of this tour coming to UW-Green Bay?
Well, the significance of this exhibit coming to particularly the Northeast Wisconsin region was an opportunity for our community to learn, but also to bring the high quality of a Smithsonian traveling exhibit to our region. So that was one of the things that our university was very excited about when we were chosen by the Smithsonian to be a host site for this social science psychology exhibit.
And can you talk a little bit about the Green Bay community, maybe changes in recent years that you felt like some education, some conversation about bias would be useful?
Yeah, one of the reasons why we really wanted to host this was the region as a residential population is changing. Currently, within our Green Bay Area Public School District, we are now a majority or a minority-majority school district. And so the population is changing. The conversation also is changing with how we as Northeast Wisconsin region are dealing with bias and how we can learn from that, recognize it and realize the influence and the impact that it has within our behaviors and also our worldviews.
We're talking to Mai J. Lo Lee, Director of Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs at UW-Green Bay, and Laura Zell, Project Manager for the Bias Inside Us Tour from the Smithsonian Institution Traveling Exhibition Service. The Bias Inside Us Tour is going to UW-Green Bay soon, and then later it'll go to Eau Claire. All right, Laura, take us through, if we go in person to meet this traveling exhibit, what are we going to see?
Yeah, so you're going to see, you're going to start in the science section. You're going to see, you know, a big 3D brain model that shows you exactly where bias, you know, is in firing in your amygdala, where it automatically happens. You're going to walk through some interactive videos to give you an idea of the research that's been behind this at Harvard University. And then you're going to start to explore other sections, bias in real life, which has examples coming out of technology, out of architecture, out of race, out of religion. And then you're going to move into this central video section, which is people talking about their experiences living with bias. There's lots of video. There's a gamification piece, interaction, where you can actually read a scenario and talk about how you would respond in a conversation. There's poetry, there's art. It's really a colorful show, and it's meant to draw people into the conversation.
And Mai, how can members of the Green Bay and area community get involved and check out the event?
So we have the honor of hosting the Bias Inside Us at our Widener Center for the Performing Arts at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. So the website is www.widenercenter.com. The admissions for the exhibit is free, so there is no registration required, unless you have a larger group that would require some more designated time and maybe some processing after. But all the hours and availability is on the website.
And is there a grand opening coming up? It's January 15th it starts?
Yes. That we've been very fortunate to be able to house this exhibit from Saturday, January 15th to Sunday, February 13th of this year.
Laura, for people who don't make it to D.C. to see these exhibits and maybe can't make it to Green Bay or Eau Claire, there is an online version as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the online version is actually packed with some interactive. There's some audio boxes that will go deeper into the science behind it. It's on biasinsideus.si.edu, and the sections are clearly labeled. All the videos that are in the exhibition are also on the online version.
And Mai, is this going to be kind of a conversation starter for your campus community there in particular?
Oh, it's definitely a conversation starter. We know that bias is an innate human trait and that we all have it. So we're just really proud to be able to explore and allow our visitors to kind of learn about the fundamental blocks of bias and the psychology behind it, and then be able to understand more of what's unconscious and conscious about our behaviors.
Laura, I think in the news the last couple of years, people might think of bias and think about racial bias in particular. And that's part of the bias inside us mission here. But that's not the only kind of bias you look at. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Race is not the only bias that we look at. There's people navigating space, whether they're in a wheelchair. There's bias as far as logos that people use. There's bias in color, different toy colors. There's bias in technology. So yes, it is not just race-based. It's all around us. And so we want to explore it from many different entry points.
And Laura, this tour has been in the Midwest for a while now. It's going to be nationwide. You've been in Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois, I think, last year. What kind of response did you get?
You know, we've had an amazing response. People, of course, it's COVID, but people have pivoted to a bunch of online Zoom panel discussions, book reads. Even we have a beautiful Spanish artist. Her name is Angelica Doss, and her work is in the exhibit. And she did, from Spain, she did a program for families. It's really, Zoom has helped us connect, of course, across the world. So that's been a strength. Some of the exhibition locations have also, of course, followed protocol and been able to hold debriefing sessions and bring in the community. So people are really trying their best to safely bring people into this space.
Mai, as you get ready for this to come to UW-Green Bay, is there a part of this Bias Insidious exhibition that's struck you as especially impactful or memorable for you?
Rob, I think for me, one of the things I really like is that it's very family oriented. One of the reasons why we wrote for this grant was because we knew that the ages that they can bring up was from 11 to adults. And so that's one of the things where we thought that the community engagement was going to be very high and that it was very interactive.
Laura, people might hear bias training and maybe pop up, you know, in their minds, they'll think of something, an official school training or an official workplace training. Their eyes might glaze over. How have you focused on making sure that this is something interesting and engaging, as Mai just mentioned?
Yeah, this is not a training. This is not a training. This is an interactive exhibit. If you're curious about how your brain works, how you make decisions, you want to have a little awareness, more awareness, and be able to reflect on how bias enters your own brain and how it, you know, is a lens for you out into the world, then come on in and see this. So there's things to pull and there's things to push and there's things to watch. And, you know, it is not a training. It's to come in and it's set up so that, you know, you can go into space, like you can enter, you know, circular areas and have reflection. And so it's set up completely different than a training.
We'll leave it there. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mai, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Laura Zell is project manager for Smithsonian's Bias Inside Us tour, and Mai J. Lo Lee is director of the Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs Office at UW-Green Bay. We talked to him about this bias education interactive project. It's coming to Green Bay January 15th through February 13th, then Eau Claire, February 26th to March 27th. You can find more information about the tour, including the virtual exhibition component. It's online at biasinsideusus.si.edu/tour. That's a lot. biasinsideusus.si.edu/tour. We'll get that up at WPR.org/Central Time as well. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, can you build a better brain? There are a lot of gimmicks and supplements that offer a boost to our minds. We'll find out what doesn't work and some of the things that might show promise with the author of the new book, The Tailored Brain. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.